Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. A new Kentucky cafe caters to Alzheimer's patients and their families.
It's just a really great way for people to get together and feel good about themselves.
Arts and culture provide economic development in one Kentucky county.
We had no money, we had no council, we had no tourism, anything. So we started looking at our assets.
A new book profiles one of West Virginia's most picturesque river valleys.
The land is beautiful. I think this valley could be a national park.
And ink lovers turn out for the first West Virginia Tattoo Expo.
We have over 150 tattoo artists doing their thing.
These stories and more coming up this week on Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. In Kentucky, Louisville has joined a growing number of U.S. cities, creating a place for people with Alzheimer's disease or other forms of dementia and their caregivers to socialize and share a meal. As Kentucky Public Radio's Rick Hallett reports, it's called the Memory Cafe.
The Memory Cafe concept can perhaps be best defined by what it is not. It's not an adult daycare for people with dementia. It doesn't provide medical care, and it's not a support group. As odd as it may sound, it is a place for people who suffer from memory loss to share memories.
It's just a really great way for people to get together and feel good about themselves and not have to worry about where they are or who they are.
That's Barry Lewis of the Alzheimer's Association of Kentucky and Southern Indiana, which along with the University of Louisville launched the city's first memory cafe in August. The idea originated in Europe in the late 1990s, and the concept is gaining popularity in the U.S., with dozens of them popping up over the past decade. On a recent Monday afternoon, about 50 people are gathered at the local Alzheimer's Association's headquarters for fellowship, lunch, and a few informal activities.
One more.
The association's Elizabeth Cook leads a discussion about the origins of some traditional sayings.
Get your ducks in a row. Anybody want to guess what that means?
Get your facts straight.
Yeah, exactly.
On this day, there are also videos and discussion of historic events and speeches, like President John F. Kennedy's stirring call for space exploration in 1962. Other times, there's music and art or the sharing of photographs. For 74-year-old Mike King, this is a place to interact with others as a person, not a patient.
I like the environment, you know, because there's some other dummies like me.
King used to run a machine shop in Scottsburg, Indiana. He was diagnosed with Alzheimer's 5 years ago.
Hey, these are other real people that are they're living the way you are living or have to live. So, yeah. Oh, well.
The Memory Cafe also offers a respite from what can be a grinding routine for caregivers who are encouraged to participate in the activities. Mike King's caregiver is Susan King, his wife of almost 29 years.
It's around the clock. There's books out there that I've been reading, and everyone is different. He is still the same person, whether he has something wrong with him or not.
Over lunch with his wife and other participants, Mike King says thanks to programs like the Memory Cafe, he's coping with his disease and tries to take the difficult times in stride.
Well, I find myself in a position where, daggone it there, I did it again. I back away and just thank the Lord for being alive, you know.
The Louisville Memory Cafe is free to attend. It's held on the last Monday of the month. A second session may be added if turnout remains heavy. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Rick Howlett in Louisville.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills.
Students at a university in southern West Virginia were recently able to meet the first African-American student to attend the school. The Black Student Union at Concord University located Billy Owens and invited him to speak. As West Virginia Public Radio's Jessica Lilly reports, Owens saw discrimination in his day, but not necessarily on campus.
It started after sophomore and Black Student Union president James Riley heard the legend of Billy Owens from faculty advisors on campus. Apparently, they'd searched for Owens in the past with no luck.
He said, "Have you ever heard of the first Black student to attend Concord?" And we said, "No, we never searched for him." So he told us that he was out there and that if we find the information, he'll help us try to find him. So he gave us a little bit of information. We looked him up in the library. We found his picture. And then eventually, Miss Terry Philpott, our advisor, she was able to locate him in the banner system here at Concord.
Owens made history in 1954 when he enrolled as the first African-American student and athlete when he joined the football team.
It became okay. Except when I joined the football team. Then I had some problems with traveling with the football team that I couldn't stay in the hotels that they stayed in, and they had to put me in another place or something that night. And some of the other teams that we played at times made some negative speeches and things as towards me. But it didn't bother me because I was there to play football, and I wasn't afraid of them, and I just told them, you know, that, look, I says, well, I'm here because I'm going to run over you.
Owens grew up in Guyto in Mercer County, where his father worked as a coal miner. He remembers the town had mostly blacks with limited segregation, but Owens says in neighboring Matoka, things were different, and segregation was enforced.
That's the only movie place we could go to. If we wanted to go to a movie, we couldn't sit where we wanted to. We had a special area just where we had to sit. Our parents told us, you know, how to react to certain things like that. And we got to the point where we knew that's the way that was the life for us. We couldn't do certain things. We couldn't go to certain lunch places to get something to eat unless we had to go. We couldn't go inside and sit at the counter or anything like that. We had to go around and go to a window where they have a window, special place like that where we had to go to.
But that's not what Owens found at Concord. Most of the games didn't require overnight trips, and the closer to Concord he stayed, the better.
What inspired me so much because how friendly and they were with me, and we were all friends, and at the times that we were together all the time, and while I was here in Concord, as quietly as it was, I never realized that I was different, because I never heard anything negative or anything of that nature.
Owen says he never thought of his time at Concord as historical until he got the phone call from the Black Student Union.
Looking for you.
And they were looking for me, yeah. They knew it was me, but they didn't know where I was. And then when they contacted me, I didn't know it was going to come up to all of this, what it is now. But I was proud of them. You know, I told them, I thanked them after I got here, and they called me and started telling me all that they wanted to do. We wanted you to do this, you want to do that. We're going to do this for you, want to do that for you. And I didn't feel that, I don't need all of that. Why have to do all of that? But that's what they wanted.
Student Union President James Riley was surprised to hear what Owen said about his experience at Concord.
I was expecting to hear him say he went through a lot of tough times. In fact, he actually said that he didn't experience any type of negativity at Concord. The players were great. The coaching staff was great. The administrators were great. And he didn't really experience any racism while he was here. The only form of racism he really experienced that he told me was when he played other teams and went to away games.
Riley is thankful that Owens helped open his door to a college education.
It was a humongous honor. I had never been able to speak to someone who, you know, was a forerunner for students like me. You know, without him taking that step out, I may not be here at Concord, you know. So it was such an honor to talk to him and meet his family and to learn about what he went through while he was at the school.
Owens majored in biology and physical education at Concord and was a member of the class of 1958. He served in the Air Force during the Korean War. He worked for 34 years in engineering at a hospital in New York until he retired in 2006. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Jessica Lilly in Athens.
This is a time of year when drivers across Appalachia have to be extra vigilant, watching out for deer jumping across the road. And in Kentucky, there are more deer to watch out for than ever. Since the end of World War II, Kentucky's deer herd population has increased 900%, becoming a common and costly hazard. WEKU's Stu Johnson has more.
With deer plentiful, the fall hunting season is underway in virtually every Kentucky county. However, Mark Maricini with Kentucky Fish and Wildlife says that certainly wasn't the case in the 1950s.
If you want to think back to about the decade right after World War II, Kentucky had about 1,000 deer in the entire state, and most all of those were in the western part of the state. So our deer herd has grown since then.
In recent years, Maricini says the overall deer herd has hovered around 900,000. Now, through year's end, there'll be a common sight along Kentucky's roadways. Hunters are also a common sight, but Maricini says they're not the people stirring up the deer.
The real misunderstanding or misinterpretation out there among a lot of people is that they're moving because hunters go into the woods. That's not accurate. Hunters go into the woods because the deer are moving, and it's more likely that they'll have success.
It's mating season for deer. Plus, as farm fields are cleared for harvest, the animals also lose their hiding places. Les Dixon with the State Transportation Office in Manchester advises motorists not to swerve to avoid deer because it can often result in a more serious collision with oncoming traffic.
You know, stay alert to the signs of deer adjacent to the roadway, you know, to... That's the key, you know, because our district and every other district in the state, you know, we're hoping each family can avoid the danger and injury as a result of wildlife activity.
During 2012, state police reported more than 2,700 deer-related crashes. There were 106 injuries, but no fatalities. Dixon says Boone County in northern Kentucky led the state with 158 collisions. For WEKU News, I'm Stu Johnson.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. In a final installment of Inspiring West Virginians, we meet a woman from Beckley who has distinguished herself on a global stage in science, technology, engineering, mathematics, and business. Jean Snediger visited Linda Powers, a bioengineer and builder of groundbreaking scientific instruments.
Jean, I'm going to take you into my biosafety level 2 laboratories in the Bio 5 building at the University of Arizona Medical School. We handle microbes that can make you sick, but generally not kill you.
But you also have a lab where you handle microbes that can kill you.
Yes, that's a BSL-3 laboratory, and that is highly regulated by the CDC. I'm Linda Powers. I grew up in Beckley, West Virginia, and I am currently the Thomas R. Brown Distinguished Professor of Bioengineering at the University of Arizona. I am also a professor of electrical and computer engineering and a professor of biomedical engineering. Okay, this is an instrument which I've built. I have a number of patents on these kinds of instruments. This instrument is particularly good for looking for microbes on surfaces.
This small handheld biosensor, one of several clever instruments that 63-year-old Linda Powers has designed, is small enough to take on a backpack out into the wilderness or the desert and can detect microbial contamination in real time.
Surfaces. Let me show it to you.
Cool. Okay.
Now, these are lights. You don't touch the sample ever.
Right.
So this is good.
Yes. It's just on top of a counter or something.
This is light. The light shines on the surface like my hand here, and the light comes from these LEDs, and this is the detector, so the light captures the fluorescence, and you read it out here, on this small computer. Or in when I was in the Arctic, we used a PDA, just a little handheld thing.
And then you can see what microbes are on that surface. That's almost right. Instantly?
Yes, instantly. Okay, because it's light. Okay, we're using light. We can't tell what species they are, but I can tell you there's microbes there and the microbial load. And the reason that's important is because these guys are communal, microbes are. And if you have large communities, you will have pathogens living in there. The instruments that I have been building for the last 15 years are aimed at looking for essentially life in extreme environments or life in places where it is very difficult to do the standard microbiological or biological testing. And so we have been building instruments that allow us to measure very, very small amounts of microbial contamination on surfaces, whether it's food preparation surfaces, the hospital operating theater, the hospital operating utensils, and air and water fluids.
Power's instrument to test water quality instantly using light can be used to monitor a city water supply or a well in an African village. She also designs and builds instruments for the Department of Defense and NASA. Much of that work is secret. But one of her instruments, for example, can detect possible bioterrorism. Another, life on Mars. Since middle school, Powers has been interested in light, or fluorescence. She was a pioneer in the use of something called synchrotron radiation, as well as X-ray absorption spectroscopy. But most of her childhood was spent in a little white house on a modest street in Beckley, West Virginia.
Beckley was a very small town when I was growing up. I knew most of my graduating class. I lived there from the time I was 3 until I left for college at Virginia Tech when I was 17. My father worked for Eastern Associated Coal Corp., and my mother was a stay-at-home mother.
When did you first realize that you were interested in science? Take me back to that day.
That was third grade. And I wanted a telescope for Christmas, and I got a telescope for Christmas, and I was hooked. Then I got interested in chemistry because the things in space were made up of different kinds of materials, and I thought that was interesting. And then I got interested in light, and I got interested in explosives, and I got interested in rockets.
Where did that come from? Where did that interest come from?
I have no idea, but it was there, and it was a very strong force in my life.
When she was in the 8th grade at Beckley Junior High, she won first place at the West Virginia State Science Fair for a project using light. It was one of many Science Fair awards.
My mom in particular didn't understand half of the things that got me excited, but she would sit by the hour and listen to me rant and rave about it.
So you were what we would now call a science geek?
Oh, yes. Very much. I came home one day from high school, I says, I want to go to college. And, you know, my father's eyes got huge, but nobody said no.
Up to then, no one in the Powers family had gone to college. To see if she was really interested, her parents suggested she take some courses at Marshall University the summer before her senior year of high school.
I took courses in chemistry, and I did some experiments that turned out far beyond what anybody could have anticipated. And I wrote it all up, and that was what I wrote to the Westinghouse Science Talent Search, which I won in my senior year in high school.
Linda Powers was among the top 5 science students in the nation. It won her a major academic scholarship. She got a PhD in biophysics from Harvard University. From there, she was recruited to lead her own research group at AT&T Bell Laboratories in New Jersey, at the time the finest research laboratory in the world. All through high school, college, and at Bell Labs, Linda Powers had a series of teachers and mentors who encouraged her to reach for the sky. What would you tell, if you could, youngsters growing up in West Virginia today, perhaps math or science geeks like you once were?
The sky's the limit, and in West Virginia, that sky's even closer. There's no reason for you to have any problem doing what you want to do. If you want it, do it. Somebody will take notice along the way and help you. They certainly did me, and this was back when girls didn't do things like that. Don't let anybody stand in your way. Decide what you want and simply go for it. You'll be surprised at the people you'll find who will support you, especially in West Virginia.
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Jean Snediger.
In the 1990s, Elliott County, Kentucky was declared the poorest county in the nation. But rather than going the usual route and focusing efforts on recruiting outside companies to come in, leaders in Elliott County took a different approach to the problem and looked towards their own strengths. Many years later, these efforts are paying off, and Elliott County is making a name for itself in asset-based approach to rural economic development through arts and culture. WMMT's Sylvia Ryerson has this report.
This one is darting minnows, and the pattern was chosen by a committee several years ago. And this one was actually one of the first ones we put up. Not the very first, but one of the first ones that we put up. We got better as we went, and I think the youth are doing a great job painting, and it's just an awesome thing to watch them.
That's Gwenda Johnson, Elliott County Extension Agent for Family and Consumer Sciences. We're standing on the side of Route 7 in the community of Little Sandy, watching men high up in bucket trucks as they hang a freshly painted green, yellow, and blue patterned quilt square on the second story of an old tobacco barn.
Well, one reason why I wanted to start the quilt trail project was to preserve some of our barns. When tobacco went, the barns started going with them. And they're such a part of our culture and our heritage and our landscape, I thought, maybe if we put the squares on the barns, then people will take better care of the barns. And it did work. A lot of people painted their barns and worked on the roofs and that kind of thing.
The Elliott County Quilt Trail Project, called the Clothesline of Quilts, first kicked off in 2005, and there are now 70 new quilt squares hung on old barns across the county. A brainchild of Gwenda's, with all the new squares painted by teenagers in the local 4-H club, the quilt trail is just one part of Elliott County's asset-based approach to rural economic development through arts and culture. As Gwenda recalls how things first got started,
it was in the early 90s. Elliott County was declared the poorest county in the nation. So the county judge executive came to the Cooperative Extension Service and told us that community development would be our major emphasis, because that's what he felt the county needed the most. So at that time, there was my coworker, Larry Rogers, who had a degree in horticulture, and me, who had a degree in clothing and textiles. So you're looking at two people who knew nothing about community development.
But they dove in and reached out to specialists from UK, the U.S. Forest Service, the Kentucky Industrial Development Council, and other agencies to see what they could make happen. Through UK,
We enrolled in the tourism internship, went to every workshop that we could possibly find in community development, and actually started working from nothing. We had no money, we had no council, we had no tourism, anything. So we started looking at our assets, and we had some specialists come in, even in those early years, to do asset mapping. And it was really interesting when people started talking about what we have instead of what we don't have. The people kind of started getting excited and wanting to do some things.
And one of the things they decided to do in the very beginning was a mural project. But they ran into one tall obstacle right away. But it wasn't going to stop Gwenda.
So started looking for an artist who would paint on a barn, but they were all afraid of heights. So Joanne and I were going... We were driving somewhere, and then I said, Joanne, are you afraid of heights? And she said, no. And I said, well, how about painting a mural? She said, now that I can't do. And I said, well, I think you can, and we're going to try. When she was painting that, the traffic on the road, they would just stop and say, you're painting where I grew up. And her reply was, no, I'm painting where I grew up. So, you know, the paintings are very cultural. And then we got a grant to offer a mural painting workshop, and we got Alfredo Escobar came up and spent a couple of weeks with us. And Tammy went through the workshop, and Joanne went through the workshop, and then they just took off. I mean, it's been awesome what's happened since then.
The day I visited the county, Tammy Boer's latest mural, a huge piece made up of 12 4-foot by 8-foot panels, was being hung right downtown on Main Street, covering almost the entire side of the Elliott County Historical Society, which opened just 11 years ago as another part of the countywide effort for revitalization. A team of volunteers, including the Elliott County Judge Executive, were hard at work drilling the mural onto the side of the building while Tammy looked on anxiously.
It'll be better when it's touched up. Them crazy men were doing that.
Is it cool to see it coming into?
It is. It's stressful. These two bottom ones here are photographs from the Historical Society.
I really like that.
And the baptism is also a photograph from the Historical Society. I created the quilting bee, and the one story, the old schoolhouse here is a schoolhouse over at Cold Springs.
As Gwenda recalls, when they were planning the mural project, they wanted to be sure to include downtown Sandy Hook, the county seat, in addition to having art across the county, and she's seen the effect of this.
Alan Gillum, who is the director of Mountain Telephone, he makes the comment that I used to drive around our town because I didn't like the way it looked. Now I make every excuse I can to drive through our town because it's very precious.
Another huge undertaking of the county as a part of their arts and culture-based development was the creation of the Laurel Gorge Cultural Heritage Center. A true collaborative effort, the initial floor plans for the space were drawn up by the county pharmacist to mimic an old tobacco barn. The building now hosts 32 interactive exhibits showcasing life in the hills of Elliott County, from the time of the Paleo Indians to the recent past, from arrowhead displays to antique cabbage shredders from the early 20th century, as well as displays on the flora and fauna of the natural environment. The space is also home of the Foothills Artisan Center, where local artists exhibit and sell their work. They're not charged for booth space, but volunteer to help keep the center open, in addition to one part-time employee. And it's been a great success in many ways.
That first few years we were open, we had people from 30-some states come and almost all counties in Kentucky and several countries. But what was the most awesome was when some older people would come in, 70s, 80s, and they would look at the exhibits, and you could hear the emotion in their voice that we can be proud. We have done something. And it was like they were seeing the picture of their life that they hadn't seen before. They had lived it, but they, to see it in front of them and appreciate it was very emotional to them. And that made everything worthwhile.
As Gwenda sees it, building on this rich history and on local talent is key to navigating the often divisive times we find ourselves in as Eastern Kentucky looks towards an uncertain future.
I have been torn with this whole controversy with coal. As an environmental educator, I see what happens to our land, but as a person who grew up in rural Eastern Kentucky, actually on a dirt road, on a small farm, in a home without running water, without a bathroom, with 10 children living there, I know what coal did. It took us from that and sent me to college. Our people are a strong, proud people. And it's to come in and say you're doing wrong is harsh. To come in and say there may be a better way, can we look together for something that we can do to replace the jobs that are being lost due to the reduction of coal? Then we can tell the people, you're important. You're important to us. And we want to be important to you. We need to find another way, something to say. You don't have to go away, but there's another way. And looking deep and looking hard and talking to the local people. What do you like? What can you do good? And building upon those strengths, I've seen people transform. Our tobacco died. I mean, the tobacco industry in our county, we were one of the top tobacco-dependent counties in the state. And when the tobacco industry died, the farmers didn't know what they were going to do. And it took a long time, and they're still searching. They're still searching for something that can replace that income from tobacco. But slowly but surely, they're finding it. And over time, we will.
When asked if she thinks their efforts have been successful, she doesn't hesitate.
We had no place to have a meeting in our county. We have one now. To me, that's success. We had nowhere for artists to even explore or to expose them to the public. We do now, and I think that's success. Do they get rich from it? No. Is it going to pay all the expenses for this place? No. But it's here, and it's ours. And the people who had a little tiny part of putting it here, they have the community pride. And I think our small communities, we hear a lot of them, news about the small communities dying. And there are reasons for that, in my opinion, that I feel when the small post offices are gone and the small schools are gone and the people are driving and commuting to work, then small communities may not have a reason to rally. And when you give a community a reason to rally, they will. And to me, that's success.
On my way out of town, I made one last stop to see a mural by Joanne Butts. On the side of the road along the banks of the Little Sandy River, the mural wraps around three sides of a huge concrete bridge support. We walked out to it together in the summer rain, you can hear it in the background, and Joanne pointed up to the brightly colored scenes.
It's just life in the gorge. Here's the ending of the big old cliff. And then there's all kinds of, they're getting in their wood for the winter. And the harvest is, they're doing their harvesting, and kids is playing. And I put in the state flower, the state bird, and the state tree. And I was born, I was the fourth person born, the fourth generation born in a log cabin. So I like to depict the log cabins just about every mural I've got.
Reporting for WMMT in Elliott County, I'm Sylvia Ryerson.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Stories and photographs from West Virginia's Lost and Kakapin River Valley are featured in a book just released by West Virginia University Press. Listening to the Land features the stories of several owners throughout the watershed who have chosen to preserve their land through the Kakapin and Lost River Land Trust. The Trust Executive Director, Nancy Ailes, says the idea for the book came from these landowners.
We got interested in doing this book because when we signed some of the first easements that the Land Trust did, people started sobbing, literally, in the easement signing in the attorney's office. And I started realizing that there are these great stories behind those tears, and so I started asking people about that. And I got some of those stories, and I love them. And then I also realized that even though people don't protect their land, that they have stories too, and they love their land just as much. It just might mean that a conservation easement isn't for them. And so I thought, gosh, we could hire somebody to capture these feelings and hire a photographer to do the same thing.
So the Land Trust wrote a grant proposal and received $50,000 from the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation to hire documentary writer Jamie Ross and photographer Tom Cogill to traverse the valley, documenting the people, their land, and their stories.
The land is beautiful. I think this valley could be a national park. And I think that the people living in it would be very good park rangers. Yeah. But most of my impressions are right in the book here. Fortunately, Jamie's and my working process together was that she would go in and interview people and kind of run interference. She was sort of a shield, so that all I had to do was go around and really get impressions and just, you know, have a sort of emotional relationship to the subject matter in the book.
A lot of your pictures are very close up, though. You got right in there, didn't you?
Oh, yes, yeah. So most of what I've done in the past is photograph people. So I approach photography as sort of a portrait-driven experience. I've never been real big on landscape photography. So for me, it was sort of like doing portraits of the land.
Now, the book's sitting here. Can you open it and show me something that you took that you're particularly proud of or like a lot or reflects what you saw when you came up through the area?
I like this one quite a bit. It's the two-page spread for the section called The Pull of Home. And it's a double truck picture, a two-page picture of an interior wall of an old abandoned house, I think it is, whitewashed walls, and probably 100 people have written their name and the date, just kind of scratched it on the wall. Some of them have extended stories. Some of them, it looks like two or three paragraphs of narrative here on the wall. Others, it's just initials and dates, but it goes back a long way. And it's a tradition, seemingly a tradition. And I did peruse it, you know, just to see if there was anything really dirty on it that I wouldn't want to put in the book. And there was nothing. There was nothing I needed to edit out. Yeah. Which is pretty remarkable, really.
So why did were you attracted to taking that picture? Was it the stories? Was it?
It's a portrait. It's a short story. It talks about the people who live here, without showing any of them.
While Cogill shot photos, Ross interviewed people. The Land Trust chose about 30 families whose stories might be interesting to hear, including those who still live there, as well as some who grew up in the valley and moved away.
We had no agenda, or we were just there. A documentarian that I worked with a long time ago said that you go to get the story they have to tell. So sometimes it wasn't the story Nancy or everybody had heard, but it was another story, you know. So whatever, so, and you probably know that, you know, that people have a story that is waiting to be shaped. And so we didn't have an agenda, and that was the hardest part, was after we had all the material, trying to figure out how to shape it into a story, because there were so many good stories, and it was so hard to choose, you know. It was so hard to choose which one and how that one fit with another one and what to leave out and, you know, and what we had to include. And then should we include, you know, what was too personal?
The 150-page book documents through stories and photos families like the Hans, Mongold, Slonikers, and Mills as they participate in activities like hunting, farming, enjoying meals, and gathering mushrooms. Do you have a favorite story in there?
Oh, it's so hard to choose. I think one of my very favorite stories that talks about the deep attachment. I mean, everybody's story in here is different, but I think one of my favorite stories is Josh Fry's, just that whole family story.
The book says Josh comes from a long line of Fry's who have worked on the family's farm near Wardensville, where Fry's father and two of his brothers died in accidents.
I mean, many of these people, and they're not plantation owners, they're farmers, you know, have been farming this land since, some of them before there was a United States. And they have held on to it, you know, sometimes having to take jobs outside the area. But Josh's family, where his mother lost one son and then almost lost another, and still they could not bring themselves to sell the property even though they moved off. And part of that, too, goes with all the funny stories that go along. You know, his father driving the hearse down in the valley to sleep in it to scare, when they were growing turkeys, to scare off the owls, I think, that were marauding, and his mother just dying of embarrassment that her husband was sleeping in a hearse out in the middle of a pasture, and just all of that, you know. And Josh speaks so warmly of, I was talking with my dad about this, about farming, when people used to move from farm to farm to accomplish the tasks, you know, they would do haying as a group and move from one place to the next.
Another profile features Bobby Ludwig from Baker, who the book says went off to college in New England and built a lucrative career on Wall Street. Ludwig no longer lives full-time in Hardy County, but he's bought and preserved thousands of acres of farmland to prevent developers from building houses on it. Ross says Ludwig had a good comeback when officials wanting to widen the state highway near his farm suggested he could just go buy another piece of property in exchange for the one they'd take.
And he says, well, how about I take your girlfriend, spend the night with her, and you just go get another one? It's not just the attachment, it's the wit and wisdom and everything they bring to it.
Ross says there were two thoughts she heard over and over again as she interviewed people. It's important to leave the land better than you found it, and your word is your bond. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. A favorite entree at Fish Fry's is the yellow perch, and that fish on the dish might have come from the Great Lakes. But warmer lake waters and a changing climate threatened the population of perch as well as other species, like walleye. The Allegheny Front's Jennifer Shveta Jordan headed out with researchers on Lake Erie to learn more.
It feels like we're in the middle of nowhere on Lake Erie. Two young women are straining to drag a fishing net onto the deck of their research boat. Finally, they pull the last bit in.
Oh, yeah!
A few dozen fish are dumped from net into bucket. Among them is a little guy with dark stripes.
Oh, my goodness.
So it's a young of the year yellow perch.
Under the engine's roar, it might be tough to hear that U.S. Geological Survey biologist Richard Krause is positively tickled about finding a little yellow perch. That's because some research has been showing that white perch might be crowding it out. The yellow perch are important to the fishery economics of the entire Great Lakes, especially Erie. And what happens in Lake Erie does not stay in Lake Erie. Because it's the shallowest and southernmost of the Great Lakes, it can signal what will happen throughout the lakes. But lately, conditions have favored the white perch.
Since about the 60s, we've had a gradual increase in temperature in the lake. Well, that correlates really well with white perch population abundance.
White perch are native to the Atlantic and considered invasive in the Great Lakes. Krause says that while some people do fish and eat them here, when they're living in freshwater, they just aren't very tasty. But if the warming trend continues in Lake Erie, he says,
it could be fantastic for white perch.
The interaction between white and yellow perch is what one Ohio State researcher has been studying for a few decades. Stu Ludson's been playing out different scenarios in his lab in Columbus. When he replicated warm, short winters for yellow perch,
egg quality was very low. Eggs were smaller in size, and they had fewer lipids, fewer calories per egg. And then in addition, hatching success of these eggs was lower.
On top of that, perch larvae were smaller and more vulnerable to predators. And as temperatures continue warming, it's not just yellow perch that might suffer. Ludson says walleye might have a hard time too.
you know, I always expect yellow perch and species like walleye to be dominant players in Lake Erie, but the way conditions in the lake are going in terms of especially the winter warming piece, it's not moving in a direction that's favoring these species.
Fisheries managers are just beginning to deal with these kinds of interactions between invasive species and climate change. It's something Stosh Burgel's working on at the National Invasive Species Council in Washington, D.C. It's a program of federal government agencies. He's leading a task force of representatives from around the U.S. He says that so far, most work on invasives and climate change has focused on exotic species on land.
We just have a longer history of dealing with invasive plants and forest pests. On the aquatic side, just in terms of managing invasive species, it's very difficult because water bodies are connected, they're flowing.
Still, Burgel says he remains hopeful that management will catch up to the research. That would be good news for the multi-billion dollar Great Lakes fishing industry and our fish dinners. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Jennifer Shveta-Jordan.
Tattoo artists and ink fanatics alike traveled from all over the country to the first ever West Virginia Tattoo Expo in Morgantown last weekend. Glennis Board brings us this report.
Tattoo contests, a Miss Tattooed West Virginia competition, and tattooing seminars were among the featured events at the expo. But for the most part...
Right now we are in the main event room of the Morgantown Event Center. We have over 150 tattoo artists doing their thing.
Rocco Cunningham is a tattoo artist from Clarksburg. He organized the weekend event.
Right now there's people everywhere looking at artwork, looking at portfolios, sitting in chairs, getting tattooed, waiting to get their tattoos. Everybody's excited. The atmosphere is outstanding.
Luna Albutt traveled from Northern Virginia, where she heard about the expo and is getting tattooed for the 10th time.
Honestly, I find it pretty therapeutic after a while because the adrenaline just kind of like goes through your whole body. And it's after the first maybe like 20 minutes, since it's a longer tattoo, it starts to feel kind of like relaxing.
But we weren't talking 20 minutes into the tattoo. We were talking just as things were getting started.
It's pretty painful. It's on my hip. So, yeah, pretty bad.
Alba's tattoo artist is well-known, Rick Cherry. He's been drawing permanent art on bodies for 43 years.
I got my first professionally done tattoo, Washington, D.C., when I was 14 years old, in a tattoo studio. And I was hooked. That was it. You know, I had to do it.
You had to actually do tattoos yourself?
Yeah, I was convinced, you know, that, you know, it was so neat that I was just going to have to learn how to do it.
Cherry also sells his own handmade tattooing equipment. He says it's a dying art, but he's passionate about machining his own drills.
In my shop at my house, I have milling machines, I have lathes, I have welders.
Wow.
And, you know, so I have to cut out all the metal, braze it together. The coils that operate the machine, I cut the cores for them, I hand wrap the electrical wire, solder everything together, and... You know, hand-cut springs, and the only thing I don't make are the screws and the washers.
Hundreds of people came out to the event in Morgantown, men and women, young and old. The expo's organizer, Rocco Cunningham, says he's been to many tattoo expos, but his is obviously the best.
What we really wanted to do was try to represent the tattoo community the best we could and also represent the state of West Virginia the best that we could. We have the opportunity to meet a lot of great artists and meet a lot of great people and promote our work, promote the art form. Tattooing is the most ancient form of art in the world.
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glennis Board in Morgantown.
You can see a slideshow of images from the West Virginia Tattoo Expo at wvpublic.org. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Moorhead State Public Radio in Moorhead, Kentucky, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, Allegheny Mountain Radio in Dunmore, West Virginia, the Allegheny Front, and Kentucky Public Radio. Our opening theme music is by Michael Lipton. Our closing theme music is by Al Petaway and Amy White from their CD, Land of the Sky, from Maggie's Music. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia, in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at our new website, wvpublic.org. I'm Cecilia Mason. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.